Welcome to Alchemist X Innovators Inside, the podcast where we explore the world of corporate innovation and dive deep into the minds of thought leaders, high achievers, and risk takers. I'm your host, Ian Bergman, and together we'll uncover the challenges, triumphs, and secrets behind successful innovation journeys. Whether you're an aspiring entrepreneur, an industry veteran, or simply curious about the ever-evolving landscape of innovative ideas and what it takes to put them into practice, this is the podcast for you. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and let's embark on this exciting journey together. Robin, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I just want to say kind of welcome to the podcast. I'm glad you're joining us today.
Thank you. I'm super excited to be here.
Awesome. Well, for those who don't know her, Robin Bolton is the founder and chief navigator. I love that title, by the way, of Mile Zero.
Thank you.
Where she works with companies that struggle with innovation to confidently and repeatedly create new revenue streams. This is something that is near and dear to my heart. Robin's experience with clients runs the gamut from global companies like Nike and Medtronic to mid-sized companies like Curriculum Associates and Hallstar to nonprofits like Donors Choose and Ariadne Labs. Robin, welcome.
Thank you. I'm pumped to be here. This is going to be fun.
It's going to be fun. You've got such an interesting set of experiences to draw on. I think we'll be talking about that. But maybe, you know, before we dig in, I read a bit of your bio. Why don't you tell us in your words, kind of, you know, who you are and how did you get here? How did you get to a conversation on a podcast about innovation and what makes it fun and hard?
So what are all the right decisions I've made in my life to get here?
Exactly. Or wrong. I won't take it personally.
All right. So yes, I've essentially spent my whole career in innovation. And I think I could tell a lovely story about how I made all these deliberate choices and it was very thoughtful. And trust me, I can string together a very coherent story, but it's not. A lot of it is luck. A lot of it is just kind of taking advantage of the moment. But I think what drives all of it is this, I just have this innate, I think, frustration of like seeing how things could be better.
Yeah.
And wanting to make them better. Like I was visiting my dad a few weeks ago and I found a childhood book that I vividly remember called Betsy's Fix-It Day. This book about this little girl, Betsy, who spent all day fixing things, like fixing her toys that were broken and all that. And the book is falling apart. And I'm like, clearly from a very early age, I just wanted to fix things. And I think it's that motivation to like, there's so much potential. Like, let's lean into it. Let's harness it. Let's do better. And so that's what kind of keeps me coming back to corporate innovation.
I love it. And that makes sense, right? Because there's 1.5 million definitions for innovation floating around out there. But I do think that most of them have a common theme of fixing and behavioral change and, you know, improving, like change. So you got to want to change things.
Yep.
That's a wonderful innate ability. Tell me a little bit about your career to date. I'm going to ask you in a second what you actually do now, but what were kind of some of the moments that, what are some of your career moments that helped you crystallize how to actually do something about this?
Yeah, I think the first one was my first job out of university. So I went to work at P&G. I was in brand management. And this is the biggest stroke of luck, is that it was a time when P&G was investing very heavily in innovation. And I was just assigned, randomly, I didn't get to choose, to what they called a new business development team. Mm-hmm. And that team was working on a new brand. That new brand, everybody now knows, is Swiffer. And so I was part of that kind of Swiffer development launch origin story and just had such a great time, you know, being part of Swiffer, being part of Swiffer WetJet, breaking all the rules in a company with a lot of rules and, you know, creating something, being part of the creation process, but in the safety of a big company. My risk profile is very low. And so there's where I learned the process of innovation, right? And I learned the importance of customer feedback and all of these important skills. And then still with P&G, I moved down to Arkansas and was on the Walmart sales team. And that's where I learned—
That's a tough beat.
It's You know what? I have to say, I have a soft spot for Northwest Arkansas, but you do have to have a sense of humor. That's like mission critical.
And negotiating with Walmart is what, trial by fire? Like, I don't really know how to describe that, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I was lucky in that being in marketing, you know, I could always just hide behind the sales guy. But I definitely did have to learn scrappiness, you know, because, you know, you have to be scrappy, you have to be nimble, you have to, you know, figure out how to negotiate anything with Walmart. So yeah, so spent time in Arkansas, figured, you know, learned how to be really scrappy and nimble, moved up to Boston, MBA, Boston Consulting Group. But then kind of the next big point was I was at Innosight for about 9 years, which is the firm that was founded by Clay Christensen.
Yep.
And so super deep into disruptive innovation, doing a lot of the work that I loved with big companies. And two big things I learned was, one, companies would always call and be like, okay, we want to disrupt ourselves. We want to be disruptive. And I'd explain, this is what that means. And then they would always say, oh God, no, no, we don't want to do that. We absolutely no to that.
Of course not. That's crazy. That's the opposite of what we do.
Right. No, that's the worst possible thing. I'm like, okay, let's talk about what we can do. But the other huge insight that I got was that innovation is not an idea problem. It's a leadership problem. And so as much as companies are like, we need more ideas, we need more process, we need more tools. Yes, and what you really need is courageous leaders who honestly will do things that don't make sense.
Yeah. And not just do, but champion and drive, like that force of personality. And I mean, we call it, what do we call it in corporate America? Sponsorship or, you know, whatever. But
yeah,
I feel like there's more emotional adjectives behind it, right?
Yeah.
You know, these companies are calling, I want to disrupt ourselves, you know, and innovation is not an idea problem. It's a leadership problem. So that resonates with me. You said something kind of interesting, though, in passing. You said, my risk profile is low, which is not what I would normally associate with innovators or with those executives, those leaders who have to champion change. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah. No, that's why I have a lot of empathy for leaders, because like I said, the innovation mantra of fall in love with the problem, like leaders, you are the problem. But I say that with love. Yeah. I say that with love and empathy. I mean, the reason most people work in a big company is that there is safety there. You know, despite all of the layoffs we've seen and the economic turmoil, a big company is still safer than a startup, or certainly feels that way.
Yep.
And I love safety, so I get it. I think what for me, what overwhelms that desire for safety is that kind of frustration of like, we can do better. Like, why, you know,
yeah,
why are we not doing better? Why are we not changing? Like, the answer for what we need to do always seems so clear that I get frustrated by like, why won't people do it? And so, you know, the fact that I have my own firm now, it's not something I ever designed or intended, but it happened. And, you know, it happened through a lot of small series and decisions where eventually I'm like, okay, I think we can do better. And I guess that starts with me.
Incredible.
And so I will do better.
I'll get into a defense of big companies later a little bit, having having worked in one, as have you, multiple times.
Yep.
But great. So this led you to Mile Zero. So what's the 90-second version of what you do now?
Yeah. So what I do now is very much like you said at the beginning, is I work with medium to large companies, usually about 100 million revenue plus, to help them use innovation to get repeatable, reliable results, and to use innovation confidently, to kind of move beyond the innovation theory that, you know, is a great place to start, but not a super helpful place to stay. Move beyond the theater, which can feel really good, but doesn't get results, to actually building a capability for innovation. And so, you know, I think of, you know, you think of like accounting and supply chain and marketing, like those are distinct capabilities within an organization. Innovation should be as well. And it needs to be approached with that kind of level of commitment and also expectation. And that's really hard to do because, you know, in supply chain, you know what you get
Yep.
for every dollar you spend. Innovation, you don't. So it's very tricky, and it requires, I mean, you know this, it requires different behaviors, it requires different tools, and it really, really requires different leadership and decision-making.
Well, it requires, to your point, it requires an entirely different system for sort of measuring results and impact, because it's impossible to have certainty on the what if, right? You have your infinitely branching set of possibilities on the, you know, multiverse. It's impossible to know.
Yep.
But I would start with the word it feels. It feels really important. I certainly think we all understand and see and feel that the world around us is changing faster than any of us can keep up with. So it feels important.
Yep.
What are, in your words, why is it important? Why should these companies that, to use a phrase that I think came from one of your old organizations, right, is designed for ultimate efficiency at the thing that they do. Why should they care about innovation? Why does it even matter?
Yeah, because, I mean, ultimately, and history proves this out, if you keep doing what you've been doing, eventually it will be obsolete. And so you need to change, and you need to evolve with, you know, the market, with the customer, with the technology as it evolves. And as a company, you can drive that change, you can follow that change, or you can resist it. And the ones who resist it are the ones who, you know, I don't want to say go away, because, you know, yeah, we have the Kodaks of the world and the Blackberries of the world. But, you know, a lot of people, when they think of disruptive innovation, they think like, oh, you know, it's devastating, like you cease to exist.
Sure.
And that's not true. Like, you know, one of Clay's examples was about how mini mills took over from integrated steel mills. But integrated steel mills are still around.
Yeah.
They just aren't the dominant model anymore. So, you know, resisting change doesn't mean you're going to go out of business. You're just not going to be the market leader you are today. So it's a matter of survival.
Well, and we see this turnover.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. It is a matter of survival. And I think it is. I think you hit on something kind of interesting. Like, you know, an executive thinking about the role that innovation plays in their organization. It's also about, what role do you want the organization to play in the future, right? If you make widget A and you always want to be the best at widget A, even if no one cares about widget A, that's great. But, you know, if you want to make the best widgets, regardless of whether it's ABC, these are terrible metaphors, but I actually think that's a really interesting insight and question for leaders to ask. Because I get into this conversation too with senior managers at major enterprises being like, why do you care? And one of my observations is that sometimes it's something pedantic. We want to be competitive. There's a threat. We need to adapt, blah, blah, blah. But the most interesting innovation leaders are, you know, kind of coming around to this idea that I think you're conveying, right? Which is that innovation forces us to have a vision for our role in the world in the future. Or our investment in innovation forces us to have a vision for what role we want to play in the world in the future, and kind of vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's super fascinating.
Yeah, it's that vision. And one of the things that I see a lot of great leaders doing, and I see as a real enabler of innovation, but also a thing that can be a big barrier, also comes down to kind of identity. And, you know, how does the leader see themselves? But then also, how does the company see themselves? And, you know, identity kind of meaning who we are and what we do. And so we all have a sense of self. If a leader sees an innovation or sees a change that is consistent with their identity or maybe stretches it a little, they're good. If it threatens their identity, that's when trouble starts. And same thing with a company, you know. You kind of ask who the company is, you know, pick on P&G, my former employer. Like, you know, they make really great consumer products and they sell it through stores. If there's an idea that is counter to that, like going direct to consumer or franchise model, like,
It's hard.
Now you have an identity conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to get real far.
That's, yeah, I love this. So this leads into something kind of interesting then for me. You know, we're talking pretty big picture stuff, identity, vision for a company and enterprise. Yet, in my experience, so often the best innovation is pretty small. It might be our accounting system is a pain in the rear end and it takes 40 steps and we should make that simpler. You know, it might be something a little more significant or customer facing, but it's small. It's an acute problem that we can identify. How do we reconcile this sort of like focus on working through the punch list of acute problems we know about with big picture, who do we want to be? Does that question even make sense?
It totally makes sense. It totally makes sense. And I'm smiling, no one can see it, but I'm smiling because I've fallen into a trap that most people fall into, which is I've kind of been using like innovation like peanut butter. I've been using it, think if I spread it all over everything, then everything will be delicious. When the fact is, like, there are different types of innovation. And, you know, you absolutely, as a company, like, you need to be doing that punch list you talked about. And the small innovations, you know, what some people call core innovation or incremental innovation, like, you have to do that. Because that's what keeps you competitive now. And it's solving those acute pain points now. And you've got to do that. The big, you know, identity, vision, you know, all of that big stuff, that is really, really hard for big companies to do. And I can't believe I'm going to say this. I more and more wonder if that really is the purview of big companies or whether that is the purview of startups. And, you know, they're the ones who are creating the big game-changing, radical, breakthrough, disruptive, whatever word you want to use. And, you know, so companies need to kind of leave that to the startups, but then figure out how to harness that work that the startups are doing at the right time to keep the big company relevant.
Oh, you are speaking my language. Okay, so this is the entire reason that I'm doing what I'm doing in the world. So I love to hear you say that, but it's actually a really interesting question. And I kind of want to dig in on it, right? When we're working with startups, because this is what I do and this is what we do at Alchemist every day, is the startup founders are our heroes and we work with them. One of the key messages is always follow your customer, right? Understand, know the customer, let them lead you to the answer. Now there's deliberate methods on how to do that. And you know, you can't just send them a survey, blah, blah, blah. But fundamentally, if you understand your customer and their changing world, you're going to get led to sort of the right answer. And I think that's actually really interesting because you said, you know, this big identity, big envisioning enterprises is hard. I have seen enterprises stumble when they confuse envisioning with innovation, right? Because we can envision. And I love it when companies do this. I love those slickly produced multi-million dollar videos that paint a picture of the future and everybody's touching walls. And I love those, but that's not where the future is going to go. That's a magical vision. That's not letting the customer lead you. That's a company leading the customer. And that doesn't work, I don't think.
No.
I'm curious if you have any thoughts on this and sort of the startup mentality of following the customer to the answer versus what big enterprises so often try and do.
Yeah, no, I'm laughing because the slick videos and the, you know, I've seen magazines and graphic novels.
They're so pretty.
They're so cool. And like you said, you know, people fall into the trap of like, oh, well, this is now our guidebook. Like now we are going to go create these solutions. And that's then, especially if you have a team who then goes off and does that, everybody else in the organization is like, what are these crazies doing?
Now I'm laughing because I've been that guy leading off being the crazy.
Yes. No, I am with you. Like, let's go be crazy. But I also know that like 90% of the organization is like, wait a minute, what about us? Like, why are they getting all the attention and the money and all of that stuff? And you don't know if you're going to get anything from it.
Or you might.
You give it to me, I can deliver. Yeah.
Exactly. And maybe to put a finer point on it, you're definitely not going to get anything from it. Like I've been that crazy and I've gone off and I've made the mistake of confusing vision with a goal, a roadmap, something you can do a backcasting exercise and then build toward.
Yep.
And I've made some mistakes, right? Yeah. Big ones, actually.
We all have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really, I'm kind of thinking out loud here, but I actually think this is pretty fascinating. Like, how do we help leaders, you know, set their organization on a course to innovation rather than just ideation? And maybe better asked is, what are some of the things that leaders shouldn't do? Are there mistakes you see them make? Are there behavioral patterns they should avoid and or do to set their organization on the right path?
Yeah, it's a great question. Because it's a little bit all over the place, the answer. So, you know, one we've already talked about is you have a leader who like buys fully into the envisioning and then kind of puts the team on that path. And again, it's great and it's fun, but the fact is most companies, and especially public companies, like you've got to deliver the year.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's plenty of research that when, especially when you do that, you know, focus solely on the envisioning, you maybe have 3 years of runway before things get cut. So there is that kind of sole focus on the far out future and no immediate results. The other mistake leaders make is the exact opposite of like, I know this will work. I am absolutely certain, you know, go. And it's like, if you are certain, it is not innovation.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it's not innovation. And so don't try to dress it up like innovation. It's okay. And so then you kind of get myopic the other way. The other thing, which I think is actually the most insidious, probably because it's the most well-intentioned, is leaders who engage in the performance of ideation. So these are the leaders who, you know, we have a hackathon or we have a shark tank or we have brainstorming sessions and nothing happens after the event.
Innovation theater.
And
nothing happens after the event. I want to dig in on that because I think that's the key thing you're highlighting here. There's no connection to what product, business, what does that mean?
Yeah, it becomes this confined event and people pour their heart and souls into the event and into coming up with the solution or the idea or whatever it is. And then there's no support to work on it afterwards. Like, you know, I'm not saying if something wins a Shark Tank that you have to launch it, but it, you know, it's not even ready to be considered for launch. There needs to be support afterwards so that you can eventually make a really thoughtful decision about whether to continue investing, launch, etc. But kind of when you just chop the creative, you know, innovation work off just because, you know, you've hit a calendar date, what happens? Because people put so much energy into it, they're like, well, what was that all for? Why does that matter?
That's demotivating.
It's super demotivating. And eventually enough cycles of this, you get cynical and then you're in real trouble.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting caution. So what do you think of something that seems to be having a bit of a moment right now? There's a bit, you know, like the pendulum swings, the trends swing, you get open innovation, you get accelerators, you get all kinds of buzzwords around. Venture studios, corporate venture studios seem to be having a bit of a moment right now. Lots of companies are investing in, you know, I think an attempt to do exactly what you're saying, right? To build a connective tissue between concept, idea, and then investment, right? Incubation and eventual scale out. Any thoughts on the model?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of venture studios. I think they have gotten closest to realizing the hope that folks have of, you know, big companies truly creating the next thing. I think they work because they are as much kind of outside as inside. And I've seen real successes come out of several of them. For me, the big question is there's kind of that valley of death, right? Between, you know, when something's piloted, created, even launched, but still small scale, and then when it eventually gets subsumed by the big company. And, you know, I know venture studios and, you know, part of their model is that, you know, what's created could be spun out and could be its own independent entity.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, great. But then how does that sustain and grow? And so I think this is more of like, there's incredible short-term results, and I'm glad they're having a moment. You know, I think there's an open question of, does this work in the long term? But yeah, even though that question is out there, that's no reason to not take advantage of the short term.
To your point, if you don't try it, you don't take action, nothing's going to happen, right?
Exactly.
But I think this is really interesting. I'm really curious how this is going to play out too, because I'm also a really big fan of the venture studio model. But part of the reason I'm a fan of it is I think it forces leaders at organizations to recognize something that maybe they know intellectually, but they haven't really internalized, which is that innovation is actually incredibly resource intensive. And in fact, your typical venture-backed startup has far more resources than the Fortune 100 company would put against the same problem, right? Mm-hmm. And so you need to be resource constrained. With infinite resources, you're going to fail because things happen, blah, 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 data shows. But it really forces, I think, enterprises to sort of confront the idea that actually, as an independent entity, this thing I'm incubating and spinning out, it needs money, it needs research, it needs functional specialists. It can't depend on, you know, the random accountant, right, sitting across the ocean who deals with your P&L. And I think that's really interesting. And I'm kind of curious if that's going to be the thing that ultimately kills these venture studios, is someone's going to lose conviction about putting 5 or 10 times the dollars and time into a concept that they would versus your typical new product development effort. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, no, that is such a great point. I hadn't thought about that, of because resource allocation is huge. I think in some ways, like, that is the crux of the challenge.
Yeah.
And you're right. Companies, enterprises have this view of innovation as something, that like can be done in 20% time. Or, you know, years ago I was at
ask any startup founder about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or like, years ago, talking to a CEO of a food and beverage company, and I was with the two people on their innovation team. And she's like, okay, we need a $250 million business in 2 years. And I just burst out laughing. I'm like, if I could do that, I would not be sitting in this room. I would be doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what? Yeah. And so I love your perspective on the venture studio model is forcing executives to reckon with the fact that innovation requires resources. And this fact may be what kills venture studios, because then we're back to resource allocation and is what kills innovation.
You know, it sort of hits at the heart of, again, this tension, right? Between an enterprise's job is to be as resource efficient as possible, basically, at doing the thing that it does, whatever it does, right? Whereas at least venture-backed startup model, which is not the only way to do innovation by any means, mm-hmm. but the venture-backed startup model is like the polar opposite. An enormous amount of resources up front against the bet that, you know, you have a 5% or 2% chance or whatever the number is of getting really efficient at doing this in the future.
Yep.
Well, that's interesting. Okay, so we've talked, I think, in the abstract about what's happening in big companies. Do you have any favorite examples that you like to roll out of large companies that have done innovation well, or maybe haven't done innovation well?
Yes. So one of the things, and this is going to sound incredibly biased, I admit that. I think for a long time, P&G actually did innovation well.
I would agree with that.
Because it set up multiple structures for different types of innovation. And so when I was there, and for a few years after I left, like, the incremental innovation, the improvements, you know, the new sense of tide, that always happened within the existing business. And so that kind of incremental innovation was just part of the DNA. And then you set up new business development teams, like what I was on, where you developed essentially adjacent innovations. And then they had organizations that were set up to create new business models and radically different things like Tide Dry Cleaners and Mr. Clean Car Wash. And so they took a very thoughtful approach to innovation. The other thing they did extraordinarily well, and this was under A.G. Lafley, was they put innovation metrics and incentives and KPIs into leaders' performance reviews.
At the board level even?
At the board level even. And so
So good.
You needed to have X percent of revenue from things that didn't exist 3 years ago. Like they built it into the incentives. And I think like that is absolutely mission critical to make things work.
Well, I think it is too. And I actually, man, podcasts are boring when we just agree with each other, but I'm going to agree with you on this and try and add something. But like, you know, I don't think it's a biased example. I think it's actually really good. And I've lived it to an extent because I, in business school myself, got to walk in, spend 4 or 5 days at P&G in Oakland and learn some things. And what I walked away with was kind of a sense of awe on the engine that it appeared that they had created for generating, evaluating, and implementing new ideas. And I was just scratching the surface, but I was left in awe. And unfortunately for me, because I think I would have learned a lot there, I couldn't personally get really excited about the kind of the CPG space. Like I'm a just tech nerd on the inside.
Yep.
But I think it's a great example because it's not one I think of often. And I think you're right. They built the structure in for the long term to follow the customer and maybe to lead and guide the customer and to do new things within the constraint of what, like maximizing revenue per linear foot of shelf space or whatever the, you know, whatever it is that they actually do.
Yep. Yeah. And having that long-term vision, it's so critical. Understand the customers. I mean, the fact is like every big company, big enterprise now was once a startup.
Yeah.
And it once, probably generations ago, like was solely focused on the customer and on solving a problem. And then for very good, very logical reasons, it grew into something that now does things bigger, better, faster, cheaper, more efficiently, and thinks it knows more than the customer.
Yeah. That's a trap at the end. That last thing that you just said. In my mind, the second you institutionally start to think we know what's best, ooh, you're in danger.
Yeah. Yes. And often it gets disguised as like, well, we need to lead the customer. Do you? Like, let's unpack what you mean by lead the customer. Because, you know, there is truth to, you know, the customer can't tell you what they want.
No, you get a Homer Simpson mobile.
Exactly. But they can tell you what their problems are and why they're frustrated. And then it's up to you to solve it. But if you think you understand that problem in the way that the customer does, you're in real trouble.
So you probably have some opinions on this, but I got to tell you, I think the industry where we've been seeing this play out in slow but accelerating speed for a decade or so now is the automotive industry. I'm thinking of poor Toyota to be in particular, and they have brilliant people, and I think maybe they're catching up. But, you know, I think this is an industry that for a very long time did not listen to what customers were trying to tell it. And to be fair, couldn't articulate because no customer can ever articulate what they're trying to say.
Never.
But about the software experience in their cars, about the energy source, about the problems that they're actually trying to solve in their lives, you know, related to mobility and a place where, frankly, at least in the US, you know, people spend a pretty significant percentage of their lives.
Yeah. And it goes back to, not to go back to the super ethereal kind of thing, but it kind of goes back to what was Toyota's identity is all around, from the outside, I've never worked with Toyota, is all around efficiency.
Yeah.
Right? Like Toyota production system. And so really digging in and exploring things like electronics and digital experience and mobility and what that means, especially in different contexts of like urban versus suburban versus rural, like that stuff is all cool.
Mm-hmm.
But weird if you're a company that is all about efficiency.
And look, I think Toyota is an exceptional company. I haven't worked there, but from the outside in terms of what they've accomplished. Yeah. And I think, you know, they're either going to continue to be a leader in the space 5 years from now, or they'll be bankrupt. Well, it's kind of nothing in between. But it is really interesting. A friend of mine, total like car geek, he bought a Toyota brand or a Toyota vehicle not long ago, and he was excitedly telling me about it. He loves this thing. And one of the things that he said is every component, every piece, every decision has been optimized to the nth degree. this thing's going to run forever. Everything in here that, you know, they have pondered over and thought, and that is a superpower. But if that's not the thing that the customers are telling you they want right now, or if that causes you to not be able to keep up with changing consumer expectations, like, it doesn't matter how well optimized your horse-drawn carriage is, right?
Yep.
That's a really interesting question.
Yep. Oh, I love your friend. He sounds like such an awesome nerd. I love it.
Well, he actually is. So shout out to Eric here. But okay. So there's another force at play, I think, with innovation. I'm really curious to get your perspective on it, right?
Yep.
We may come back to other big companies when we talk about tech giants like Amazon or Apple. But for now, let's talk about luck. Let's talk about these both new ideas, Swiffer, or companies that are transforming themselves. You know, Nokia has done a pretty good job of reinventing themselves. We'll see if they do it again.
Yep.
How much of a role does luck play in innovation versus how much can you deliberately guide towards?
That is a big question. Luck definitely plays a part. Without question, luck plays a part. If only from, you know, like getting the timing right. So you got to get the timing right. You got to get the team right. And, you know, humans, we are fabulously unpredictable. And so, you know, something could go wrong with the team. You got to get, you know, make sure you're understanding the problem is right. All these things have to be right to be successful. And just the odds of that happening are low. So there is luck that is required.
Yeah.
There are people who say, oh, well, luck is preparation meets opportunity. So
it's a good formula.
Yeah, you can prepare. You can put things in place. But there's still that opportunity, that element that is outside of your control. And so luck is absolutely a factor. How big of a factor it is, you know, I think that probably changes by industry, time, you know, immediate context. But I don't think you can ever rule out luck.
I don't either. And I think anybody who tells you otherwise is, you know, deceiving themselves, right? They're the guy who won the lottery, stands on stage and then says, you can do it too. Let me tell you how. If I can do it, you can do it, right?
Yep.
But I want to kind of double down on this point on preparation, right? Mm-hmm. Luck is, in my mind, it's not going to help you in a positive way. Mm-hmm. Unless you are doing the things, whatever the things are, you have the infrastructure in place to continuously understand the customer, test out new ideas, stay close, et cetera, right? If I think about this in the startup context, yeah, you know what? Luck is a huge force and it's hard to control for. I think the biggest piece of luck in the startup world is probably timing, right?
Yeah.
Right idea, right team, right tech. Is it now or is it next year or is it last year actually really matters. And that's pretty hard to see without the 2020 of hindsight. But you don't get to understand, you don't get to kind of commiserate about, oh, luck bit us on this one, unless you've put the infrastructure in place to try the idea to begin with, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, oh, you know, we were unlucky. It's like, we didn't get funding. Well, were you out there? Were you talking to people? Were you making the pitches? Were you doing everything you could to put yourself in a position to get a yes? Oh, you know, we didn't get product market fit. You know, customers really didn't pick up. Okay, well, did you do the work to really deeply understand the customer, or were you solution led? And you could still do all the right things and it not work out, but it is definitely not going to work out if you don't do all the right things.
I think that's actually a really interesting takeaway, and we shouldn't underplay that, right? Like, you can't control luck, but you can control for creating opportunity, right? If you invest, something will, you know, will happen. It could be good, could be bad.
Yes. Yes. Could be good, could be bad.
But, you know, to a point you made earlier, if you shy away from it, right? If you either think you know what the answer is going to be, or you just don't create space for innovation because you're focused, because you know what you need to do to hit your goals this quarter, luck's never going to have a chance to come in and help you. Well, that's kind of interesting. Okay. Well, I had another. I like these kind of sort of philosophical questions. I had another one that actually one of our clients and partners, a big overseas kind of multinational enterprise, a senior manager there asked me a little while ago. When was this? This actually might have been last year. It's kind of stuck with me though. Okay, so you're talking about innovation and you're talking about the potential for reinventing yourself. It might be incremental, but you might just reinvent yourself. He asked, should we do that? Like, do we lose our identity? In this case, this is a big media company, right? Like, if we are adapting to customers and changing trends, do we risk losing who we are? So I thought that was a really interesting question because, to be honest, I didn't feel like I had a good answer to that because, to an extent, maybe, and maybe that's a bad thing. Maybe your role in this case as a media organization is to be sort of a bulwark against certain types of change you don't believe in. Anyway, but that's kind of stuck with me because I don't know the answer to that. I'm curious if that sort of existential struggle has come up in your work.
Yeah, it has. And it usually comes up kind of, as you said, in those one-on-one conversations where you can get really philosophical and you're not going to freak anybody out on your team. And it is, it's hard to give an answer because you really then have to dig into, okay, well, you know, if you're worried about losing your identity, what do you think your identity is?
Full circle. That's good.
And so, I mean, you can come up with like, this is, I feel like this is a bad example, but you know, the railroads, like railroads thought they were in the railroad business when they were actually in the moving things from point A to point B business. So, you know, especially media, like, okay, well, what is your identity? Do you make movies or do you tell stories? You kind of need to get into that and unpack it. And the answer may be, as you said, yes. Like who you are may become less and less relevant as time goes on. And that's just, you know, origin of the species, Darwinism. Like I hate to say it, it sounds cold, but like that's okay.
That is okay. I think that's so important because if you're deliberate about it, right? If you are deliberate about saying, you know what? I build railroad ties. That's what I do. And I love it. And somebody needs to build railroad ties. And, you know, and if the market shrinks, well, I maybe shrink a little and that's okay, which is very different than, you know, I manufacture wood-based transportation items. But I actually think that decision point is really important to set an innovation team and an innovation program up for success because you do need bounding boxes around innovation. They can be very, very wide. They can be very, very narrow, but that is a pretty deliberate decision to sort of set the team up for knowing like what space are we working in?
Yeah, no. And that's the thing. It's about making a conscious decision so that you're not the victim of things around you. Like that is the best way to kind of control your own fate in a world that is uncontrollable. It's like, make a decision about where the box is and, you know, what you are and aren't willing to do. But, you know, so often it's like, innovation, go do anything. And it's like, yeah, no, that's a huge waste of resources.
Well, yeah, and I think it is. And this can make things a little more palatable for executives who are allocating resources and funding, right? With that vision comes a certain amount of dollars you'll put behind it. And it doesn't have to be a trillion. It doesn't have to be a billion.
Right. And you're not constraining creativity. That's something I hear a lot. It's like, oh, no, we don't want to put boundaries on it because then we're going to constrain the creativity. It's like, no, you're actually allowing it to thrive while being very mindful of your resources. And so, you know, you have finite resources. Put the constraints on so that people can be as creative and productive as possible on things that have the highest likelihood of seeing the light of day. And like you are enabling and driving creativity if you do that. You're not diminishing it.
Wow, that's smart advice. So why hasn't this worked? And hasn't it worked? I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to say that despite you and I chatting here, despite thousands of other very, very smart people working in the innovation space, we as an industry haven't actually cracked the nut. Why is that?
Yeah, we definitely have not cracked the nut. I think I go back to kind of what I said in the beginning, is it's a leadership problem. And I don't want people to think I'm blaming leaders, because honestly, I would probably do exactly what most executives do if I were in their shoes. Because again, you're at a big company, because there's safety in that versus a startup, and you have, you know, key indicators, key metrics you have to hit and you have to deliver. And if you don't, you don't get a bonus, and you miss them enough times, you lose your job. And very rarely are those metrics and incentives supportive of innovation. And you also look at, like, you know, tenure in a role, what, 2-3 years? It takes innovation a lot longer than that to really get a grounding, even if it does get launched. And so as an executive in an enterprise, in order to support innovation and really be in it for the long haul, you have to make so many decisions that are counter to your own good. And, you know, so you'll probably miss some of your metrics. You probably won't get a huge bonus. And even if you are wildly successful, you won't be in the role that benefits from the innovation you created.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, in so many ways, there's no logical reason for somebody in a company to take that kind of risk. And so that's why when you do have success stories, and there are success stories out there, you know, the person really is unique, because they are investing in legacy, they're investing in the long term. And why so many other folks, and again, like myself included, would make the very logical decision, which is, hey, yeah, I have a dollar. I know that if I give it to, you know, supply chain over here, I'm going to get $1.20 back. If I give it to you, yeah, I may get $10 back in 5 years, or I may get nothing.
Yeah.
You know, what choice would any of us make?
Well, and it is another actually really nicely actionable thing that I think leaders can do for themselves to control their own destiny, right? Is to ask this question, like, you know, do I want to be a person going out on a limb, driving change, sponsoring, funding, investing in, you know, ideas around innovation, you know, while recognizing that I might be building a legacy I'm not around for, it might not work, I might not be able to afford that vacation because my bonus didn't come through, whatever it is, or that yacht. I don't know what level we're talking about here, but but you can control your own destiny there. And I for one really think it's okay to recognize that incremental innovation needs to have a structure and funding and investment around it. It'll keep you competitive, keep you efficient over the long term, and not try and reinvent the wheel unless you really want to reinvent the wheel.
Yep. Yeah, no, 100%. And for leaders, again, to kind of recognize, like, here's my risk appetite. Like, I have a very low risk appetite. So I'm willing to do the incremental innovation because I see the need for it. But, like, I'm not going beyond that. And other people would be like, you know what? I want to push the boundaries, but I'm not willing to go crazy. So, like, yeah, I'll be in the adjacent space. I'll work in, you know, some of the corporate incubators and accelerators. And then there are the folks further out.
Yeah. This reminds me of a fun conversation I had with someone. It was a former boss of mine at Microsoft in the Windows division. And she's one of the most brilliant people I've ever met. And we were having a one-on-one, and we kind of got into full-on, like, balls-to-the-wall argument over a single question.
Oh, okay.
It was around, you know, should Microsoft, and actually really specifically the Windows division, the operating system division in Microsoft, invest in innovation? And I was arguing yes, and basically saying we're not doing it and we need to. And, you know, she was like, what do you mean we're not doing it? Like, I've got innovation, you know, millions of dollars. We got hardware, we got Surface, we got, well, all kinds of stuff. And I sat there and I was like, look, we haven't launched a successful new product in 14 years. Like, this division, Windows, has not had a new product in 14 years. And, you know, she came back at me. She's like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, Windows 8, Windows 8.1, Windows 10. I don't remember when we were having this conversation. I was like, that's not a new freaking product.
Right.
Like, we are serving the exact same needs for the same type of compute. We are evolving it. And that's great.
Yeah.
But it's not a new product. Like, do we want to set ourselves up to launch a new product? What's kind of interesting is at the time, I maintain I was right about the lack of innovation. However, I think what I was wrong about, I think knowing what I know now, I would have actually argued the other position. I would have argued this is not the organization that should invest in innovation. This is the organization that should be incremental, be effective, do what we do well, which is to democratize access to the latest things at scale, be a fast follower. Mm-hmm. And I would step up a level as an executive, hypothetical executive in this case, and allocate resources to another part of the organization that has the ability to take a risk and launch.
Yep.
Because a large company or a large organization, Windows at Microsoft, you know, the Camry line at Toyota, a risk can have real consequences on a multi-billion dollar business that employs hundreds of thousands of people.
Yep.
And that is a real disincentive.
Yeah. And that's such an important point of, you know, one, I'm laughing because in the story, I would have done exactly what you did. Like, what are you talking about? We're not innovative. And then I, you know, put my much calmer hat on. Like, what do you mean by innovation? Like, what does innovation mean to you, boss? So, you know, so that gets into then kind of like, how much are you willing to innovate? How much risk are you taking on? And the great point you made about doing something dramatically different, you know, something that is risky, something that could put reputation at risk, has to be done outside of that core business for a whole lot of reasons. It's really hard to change how you think. Like, we all see things, you know, in our certain paradigms, and we have heuristics. And, you know, I was even on a call earlier today where we were trying to modularize something, and I'm like, kept trying to take the whole and break it down into parts. And someone's like, well, what if we thought about it completely differently? And I couldn't. Until somebody's like, well, what if we did, you know, this topic? And I'm like, oh, now I understand what you mean by differently. So if you spend all day, every day, kind of in like the office world and improving office and troubleshooting office and getting from Windows 8 to 8.1, it's not reasonable to expect you to also then kind of after lunch be like, and how can we completely change the business models and what new technology? Like, you just can't.
And that extends, if you're a payment processor and you process payments, if you ship, you know, pallets from one place to another, that is a universal truth. Yeah. Okay. Well, I have one more thing I'd like to, we're kind of, man, I could go forever. We're coming up on the end of our hour here.
I was going to say I could keep going, but yes.
But I want to take a hard left turn.
All right.
Because innovation doesn't require technology, but I'm just going to go out and say it's often driven by new capabilities.
Yep.
And we have a big old one happening right now in AI, generative AI, artificial general intelligence, whatever. I would argue nobody actually knows where this is going except that it's big.
Yep.
And tell me, innovation, AI, what are your conversations like with your partners, your clients, your industry colleagues right now?
It is exactly what you said. Oh my gosh, this is big. Oh my gosh, this is going to change everything. I have no idea what to do. We need to do something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
That's a good place to start. And so I think we are in this very messy, ambiguous place right now where yes to all those things. Yes, it is big. Yes, it is going to change everything. So I should say most of us are experimenting with this. There are some people who are flat out resisting it. This is the next big thing. Like, I am old enough to remember when the internet became a thing. Like, this feels like the next internet in terms of the magnitude of change it will have. But the internet didn't like debut in whatever it was, 1995, and then everything changed the next day.
Right.
It was like decades. So it's going to be a long time for us to really figure out how innovation comes in or how AI comes into play. But to what we've been talking about, like just not even deciding, but being open to it, being choiceful, experimenting, being willing to learn, that is so critical because it is going to change the way we work.
Yeah. Being really deliberate about, yes, having the infrastructure in place to stay connected and being really deliberate about trying to understand what this means for your customers is pretty much the only advice that I've been able to get. Look, that makes a lot of sense. I am definitely of the position or coming down the position that the current pace at which AI is going to change things is unlike anything we've ever seen in terms of the combination mm-hmm. of the pace and the scale of change. And mm-hmm. well, okay, so my degrees are in like politics and sociology and like, you know, I have a lot of academic curiosity / terror around that.
Mm-hmm. But oh, totally. Yeah.
But it does kind of reinforce the thesis, right? It reinforces the thesis that if you want to keep up with and stay ahead of change in the world around you, you need to have an innovation function that is not theater, that is connected to the customer and connected to the business. And yeah. you better depend on it to keep you informed about what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, yes, there are a lot of scary things about AI, and like, it's very easy to write the dystopian novel.
Sure.
In fact, you know, those have already been written, in fact. But this is big and it's happening, and ignoring it, resisting it, that is the wrong choice. You don't have to love it, but you need to lean into it and be deliberate about, okay, what experiments are we going to run? What technologies are we going to understand? How could we use this? And how won't we use this? But sticking your head in the sand is not an option,
yeah.
or at least not a good one.
Well, we at least know where that'll leave you, right? The
yes.
the history is littered with organizations that are no longer around
Absolutely.
Or no longer relevant for that reason. Well, okay, that's a really happy note to end on.
Yay!
But so this has been a really fun conversation. We've hit on some, I think, some good kind of things for leaders to keep in mind, some pitfalls to avoid. I want to ask you one final question, drawing on your career advice. If you were speaking to an early career professional who wants to play in the space of innovation, whatever that means to them, what's one piece of advice that you would give this person?
Only one piece of advice. I would say stay open.
Stay open.
And what I mean by that is, you know, in your career, in your personal life, in the projects you work on, things are going to happen that you don't expect. And a lot of times your instinct will be to like to panic and to resist. It's human. Again, I have done it. Take a deep breath and get curious about things. When you get the surprises, when the unexpected happens, get curious and do something that scares you, not something that terrifies you. One of the things I would say is like, stretch, don't splatter. Like, stretch yourself. If something downright scare, like terrifies you, don't do it. But like, be open to that discomfort.
Yeah. Take a deep breath and get curious is wonderful, actually, advice. I love that. So amazing.
The deep breath is absolutely key in that
yes,
moment.
It really is. Oh, if only I had practiced that. Okay. So, Robin, this has been a lot of fun. For folks that want more tidbits of wisdom or to follow what you're doing, what's the best way to keep in touch? Is it LinkedIn, your website? Where should folks look for you?
Yeah, you can go to my website. It is milezero, so zero spelled out, .io. And you can get tons of information there. You can sign up for, I send out a weekly blog post. I send out a monthly newsletter that mostly people just enjoy the photos of Lego minifigs that are in there, which is fine.
It's totally fine. Are you a trained like Lego ideation? There's a name for this, like doing the Lego ideation.
The Lego serious play.
Yeah.
Not yet. Yet Ooh. Being the keyword. So yeah. So go to my website or connect with me on LinkedIn.
Amazing. Well, you heard it. Milezero.io. Connect with Robin on LinkedIn. Thank you so much for your time. This was a lot of fun.
My pleasure. I had a great time. Thank you.
So that's a wrap for today's episode of Alchemist X Innovators Inside. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you found value and insight in today's discussion, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast and never miss an episode. Don't forget to share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone who is passionate about corporate innovation or just curious about great ideas and practical insights. Until next time, I'm Ian Bergman. Thanks for tuning in.